Hello and welcome to the Dense City Podcast, a show where we meet with academics to discuss their research on cities. I'm your co-host, Isaac Keast. Today we welcome Dr. Vanessa Matthews, an associate professor of geography and environmental studies at the University of Regina. In her research, she investigates the links between historic buildings and embodied energy, with a particular interest in the role that existing buildings play in urban sustainability. She also explores embodiment in urban space, specifically how movements of the body are transformed, limited, and directed in public space. Vanessa is also the principal investigator on an insight development grant from the Social Sciences and Humanities Research Council alongside Dr. Roger Picton of Trent University, studying the effects of craft beer on small towns in Ontario. Coming up, we'll be discussing her article, Planning for Craft Breweries, Neolocalism, Third Places, and Gentrification, published in Urban Geography in 2022. The article's premised on the idea that the extent to which craft breweries play a role in gentrification in mid-sized cities is directly tied to planning practices which regulate their geography. The article focuses on neolocalism and third places, two consumption practices which shift the image and identity of a place and are intertwined with urban change. The article demonstrates how craft breweries are positioned as agents of urban change and gives some insight into the spillover effects for their neighborhoods. With that, Dr. Matthews, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
My pleasure. As we always do at the start of this show, could you walk us through the purpose of your article and what you were looking to explore with it?
Sure. So I was really interested in the relationship between gentrification and craft breweries. And much of the research that has kind of explored that relationship up until this point has kind of focused a little bit more on larger metropolitan centers. And so I was really interested in kind of pulling some of that framework down to kind of mid-sized peripheral cities in the Canadian prairies. And I was wanting to kind of understand if there were ways that we could figure out where gentrification would be more likely to happen amongst craft breweries and to try to really create that detailed case study of what's happening across an entire city.
What drew you to craft breweries? Because when I saw your article, I kind of made the connection myself in my head that new gentrifying neighborhoods and city centers, craft breweries kind of go hand in hand with those. And I never really thought too much about it myself. So what led you in that way?
Craft breweries are really interesting to study, I would say. In Canada, we hit a point in the 1980s where we only had about 40 breweries that remained still. Most of those were industrial and regional breweries. And so we had, because of acquisitions and mergers, we had a very small, limited number. And then they start to grow. And so by the time we hit the 2000s, they start to grow in a really large kind of exponential way. We're over 1,200 now breweries across Canada. Most of those are craft breweries. So our small scale, independent microbreweries, nano breweries, brew pubs, they constitute the vast majority of that amount. So they have a whole bunch of different social and economic effects that they're kind of associated with. And that is happening all the way from large metropolitan areas down to small villages. So we kind of have this really interesting spread across urban hierarchies for the breweries. And so people have been looking at their relationship to adaptive reuse, and they've been looking at some of the social and economic effects that are kind of taking place. And as I mentioned, they're looking at that question of gentrification, but there aren't a lot of researchers at this point that are looking at the question of where they're going and whether or not urban planning has some role to play in kind of creating particular places where they're kind of being pushed towards or kept out of. And so I became really fascinated with this question of whether urban planning has something to do with where gentrification might be taking place. So urban planning, of course, is basically laying out the land use bylaws,
right,
and making it clear where craft breweries and breweries at large are going to be permitted, where they're going to be discretionary, so kind of at the discretion of a city council, and where they're completely prohibited.
And that would be the zoning bylaws you're referring to.
Yes. Yeah.
Which we'll be talking about later. Did you have any theories or hypotheses before you went into this research of what you might find based on your initial interactions with breweries in Saskatchewan, Regina and Saskatoon specifically?
Absolutely. So I knew that there was some clustering taking place, just having visited the two cities and living in one of them. I knew that there was that spatial concentration, and I knew that there was definitely a link between craft breweries going into kind of more historic, older spaces. But I hadn't really sat down and looked at the zoning. So, you know, thinking that there seemed to be some kind of concentration, and when you have a concentration, it's either because there's a, you know, from the perspective of breweries, it's a really great space to enter into, or from the perspective of a city, it's a good place to kind of house and contain a use.
You cite a lot of existing research at the top of your article, and you identify the gap that you'll be exploring. Can you explain for us some of the major literature you leaned on initially to inform the paper?
So in terms of getting at that question of urban planning and gentrification and craft breweries, I wanted to kind of focus on where the literature was at in terms of that core relationship between gentrification and beer through kind of an urban lens. And then I wanted to look at some of the consumptive elements that are also associated with craft breweries in urban centers. So here I was drawing on literature coming from a food and beverage kind of perspective, looking at the role that craft breweries might be playing as third places and also their role within a shift towards neo-localism. And so I was interested in those kinds of consumptive elements, which you might kind of refer to as creating linkages outside of the craft brewery site and a way to kind of measure what was happening outside of that site specifically. So I was kind of interested in mapping that. So it ended up, to get to that question of craft beer and urban planning and gentrification, I'm kind of trying to construct how we can use these consumption forces that are tied up with these processes to try to understand what's actually at play. So that means working towards understanding some of those social and economic effects that they are creating within the urban centers and more specifically in the neighborhoods that they're housed in, and then also trying to understand the types of locations that they're entering into as well. So there's an interesting body of research that has happened in geography, where at the beginning, everybody was kind of noting the fact that we had craft beer going into industrial historic landscapes and creating some really interesting effects and changes within those spaces. And then craft beer starts to go into other places. And so that whole network of understanding the location and the type of buildings that craft breweries are interested in being housed in was another part of that puzzle. So it kind of came together with a number of different strands and different questions that are being asked within the academic kind of community about the effects that craft beer is having, the location of where they're going, and how it's creating a new kind of form of production and consumption.
I actually work for a development company in BC, and we rub up against the zoning bylaw everywhere. And it straddles that line between industrial and commercial use. And I mean, with a lot of places not even being very receptive to mixed use, it can be sometimes a challenge to figure out where craft breweries go. And that can be kind of a prohibitive thing, but it can also allow them to sneak in and, you know, get their use classified as a lot of different things, right?
I absolutely agree with you. And, you know, I've done research on smaller towns and their how craft breweries are kind of where they're located and what that process is. And it's exactly what you say. When you get to those smaller scales, they haven't really created the same kinds of restrictive measures and zoning oftentimes that we might find in larger municipalities that have had to bump up with some of those questions. So it creates a new kind of set of challenges, I think, at the smaller scale, but another really interesting kind of way of thinking about the place of craft beer.
Yeah, and in a place like Saskatoon or Regina, I imagine just because they have the populations, they've needed to think about these things and plant their flag in one camp or another.
I think one of the interesting things that happens is that, you know, because up until the 1980s, we don't have a lot of craft breweries, that small scale, independent type of space within our cities, we end up bringing them into our zoning bylaws as almost like a industrial brewer or a regional brewer, which is much larger in scale. Mm-hmm. And so I think we've kind of classified them in that way, which is why we have, when we're looking at, you know, cities across Canada, Canada, most of the time, the places where craft breweries are going to be housed is necessarily going to be in industrial areas because we're still kind of classifying them in those terms.
And when you talk about third places in this article, it's right in the title. I want to talk about that a little bit right off the bat. So I was wondering, though, if you could give listeners a good explanation of what that means, third place. What does that look like?
Absolutely. So this was a concept that was coined by Ray Oldenburg. And the idea behind a third place is that it functions as a space between the first place, which is home, and the second place, which is work.
Mm.
So third places, by definition, are supposed to offer a space where people can linger, a place where you can have social gatherings and social exchange taking place. And so we have lots of examples of third places that are consumptive based, let's say, where we have, you know, cafes that might be falling into this type of definition. Bookstores would kind of fit into this, restaurants and craft breweries would fit into this. Outside of those consumptive-based third places, we also have third places that can be parks and public spaces and you know, a network of spaces that people can gather in and collect and build community in different kinds of ways. So what's happened over time is that we're losing some of those third places in a more public kind of sense. So we're seeing a decline in the kind of true public spaces.
Right.
And we're seeing a rise in these more consumptive-based public spaces, third places kind of performing this role.
Mm-hmm. The reason I wanted to get that third place definition cleared up is because I didn't notice you mention industrial places. So a craft brewer, they're less similar to an industrial place in that they offer a third place option. Whereas those big brewers that maybe craft breweries historically fell under, that definition wouldn't really be up to date anymore.
I agree. It's interesting because of the way that we've zoned craft breweries as industrial uses. What that's meant is that breweries that are wanting to kind of create a social space within their brewery that are housed in industrial areas end up becoming destination sites. So you know, when you're thinking about a really great third place that is working really well for its community, I always think about places that people can walk to. They can, you know, they can use many different methods of transportation to get to them. They can stay at them for long periods of time. When you move third places into an industrial area that's probably not well-serviced by public transit, that doesn't have great bike lanes and walkability, then you're forcing people into private vehicle use to get there.
Mm.
And you can't really create that same type of foot traffic or, you know, the spillover effects that you would see in other places. And this is something that even when Oldenburg was writing this in the 20th century, he was writing about the fact that we seem to not want to put commercial third places in places where people actually live. So we have created these zoning rules that make it really difficult to have effective public places and third places in the spaces that people are living in.
Yeah, that's, I think anyone who looks at a zoning map, say, I used to live in Toronto. And if you look at even a zoning map of Toronto, the swaths of single family detached dwellings with, you know, not a single red dot for commercial anywhere. I remember I lived in a little neighborhood in Toronto and one day a cafe opened across the street and it was like the best day of my life because it was a residential neighborhood. Nobody expected it. And I swear that cafe had a line down the street, but it works. People love these third places, but you're right. They're kind of getting zoned out. I mean, you can make an argument saying that we're kind of turning that tide, but it takes a while.
It does for sure.
It's funny that sometimes these craft breweries can pop up in warehouse areas, industrial areas, not serviced by transit, not walkable, not near residential neighborhoods. And their purpose is to serve alcohol.
Yes.
So you're kind of rolling the dice on that one.
For sure.
So let's get back to the paper. Could you walk us through the methodology for this paper? How did you go about studying craft breweries and their effects on their neighborhoods?
Yeah, so I wanted to do site visits first. So I went to... There was 14 breweries at the time of writing that would have been classified as a craft brewery in the two major cities in Saskatchewan, so in Saskatoon and Regina. So I went and I visited each of those sites, and I wanted to document both what the building was like that they were being housed in and also neighboring uses and make a lot of field notes. So I took lots of pictures, did lots of field notes on those areas. And then I combined that with an analysis of planning documents coming out of both cities to try to understand how breweries were becoming part of broader trends at a city level. So looking at official community plans, any kind of reports or plans that were being created in terms of intensification goals, like trying to create greater density in particular parts of the cities. I did media analysis to try to look at the impact of each of these breweries on their surrounding neighborhood.
By media, do you mean like social media?
So I looked at, newspaper articles and tried to see if there were any kinds of discussions on, you know, the time in which the brewery had entered into a neighborhood, if there was any kind of discussion or debate around whether it should be present in that neighborhood, what some of the effects would kind of be on that location. And then I also did an analysis on all of the websites. So part of this was to try to look at how the brewery was linked with the local. And that is part of this bigger trend towards neo-localism. And so I was looking at any instances on their websites where they are referring to place names or landscape features or talking about collaborations, all of those kinds of different elements there. So it was a pretty broad kind of multi-method approach to try to get at this question. And part of that is like looking at the zoning maps, looking at the community plans, and part of it is just the act of going to these sites and analyzing what's taking place.
And did you say there's 14 of those between the two cities?
That's right.
That sounds like just a very qualitative methodology. It's a good thing it was a manageable number.
Yes, and I think that was part of the beauty of it in some ways, right? Is that by having a number that is much more possible to do that really kind of large scale deep analysis on each of those sites, it meant that it provides a really good case study of what's happening on a whole, right? It's harder to do that when you're looking at a place like Toronto and you have, you know, dozens and dozens of breweries within that one city. It's harder to kind of figure out and map all of those different elements.
By the end of the study, you'd have to start over again.
Yes, totally.
So anyways, let's get into some of your findings from the study. Can you walk us through some of your findings and tell us what you found about how craft breweries impact their neighborhood and how they're received?
In terms of the findings, one of the interesting things that emerged was that I really had to pay attention to whether these spaces were more production oriented or more consumption oriented. And then kind of coupling that with the zones that they were located in, I was kind of trying to map out some of those relationships. So the findings basically suggested that craft breweries that were consumption based, so they're the ones that have the third places that we were talking about. They kind of function to have that space for gathering, space for community. Those breweries that are consumption-based and that were located in close proximity to residential areas were the most likely to become entangled in some way in gentrification. So they're the ones that are most likely to have the spillover effects outside of their unique site. So they're going to kind of create the greatest amount of change and effects on the surrounding uses. And so part of that then is that if we know that that's what we're looking for, we can kind of plan accordingly, I think.
The commercial-based spaces, they got picked up more in the media, I assume, and they were more fought over.
Absolutely. So the places that were more consumption oriented, that were in commercial spaces housed within that residential area, were the most likely where people were talking about the potential risks of having a brewing site or a space of alcohol consumption within that neighborhood. They're the most likely to be discussed as part of like a wave of turnover that might be happening on a particular street as well. Or, you know, there was some discussion of, you know, since this brewery got to this particular location, it has spurred additional interest by the retail sector to come in.
Right.
So it's interesting just to look at media and to kind of think about how it also reflects some of those effects.
intensification, I know, came up a bit in your article because they often have adaptive reuse as part of their whole existence. Could you tell us a bit about some of the benefits and drawbacks you came to conclude were related to craft breweries?
It's a great question. I would say that, you know, one of the benefits is that craft breweries tend to go into existing spaces as opposed to building new spaces. So
Right. The
majority of the breweries that I was looking at were housed in historic existing built form, many of which those sites were kind of vacant prior to the brewery going into them and kind of working to rehabilitate them in some form. So I think that that's a benefit for sure, that we are able to kind of bring new life and a new image and a new identity into some of these underutilized spaces. And that can spur kind of further investment then within a particular location or a particular neighborhood. In terms of broader trends, like both Saskatoon and Regina have trends to create greater intensification in core areas. So we have lost a lot of the population and lost some of the uses that would be characteristic of downtown spaces in both cities over a period of time. So both cities have been kind of growing outward at a cost to growing upward in core areas.
Mm.
So, you know, Regina is particularly falling behind in these trends. We actually lost people last year within our core area. So there's a need to kind of work towards thinking about the types of uses that could create greater vitality and greater interest and attract people back into a core area. So I think craft breweries, because they're able to go into a space and completely transform the image and identity and meaning of that space, they are able then to perform that role of catalyzing additional functions and interest within a broader kind of area. So I think in both cities, they have the potential to create greater intensification to great, and by intensification, I'm talking about greater investment into commercial spaces. I'm talking about residential growth as well. So kind of thinking about how to create more intensity and more density within the core areas. And that's necessary if you want to have, you know, public transit and some of the other interesting things that can come about.
Absolutely, yeah.
So that would be another big kind of benefit of those spaces. I think social and economic effects as well. So if we're looking at social and economic effects, they often have the potential of offering the third places that we talked about, how there's a lack of places that people can go to build community and social gatherings and everything else. And that has become even more strained through people forming communities online. So not in physical places, but doing it in a much more social media kind of way. So the development of those spaces are really important. And then economically, they have really good spillover effects too. So they tend to work with local businesses and services for anything that they need.
Like food trucks, I think you mentioned.
Absolutely. So food trucks, there's a lot of collaborations between soap makers and craft brewers and coffee makers and brewers and chocolate makers.
Soap makers.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay.
They'll have like beer soap in a lot of the breweries. And I've even not in my area, but I've even encountered like craft beer treats for dogs, which is kind of an interesting.
The economic opportunities are endless.
And I think part of it is that when you're making beer, you have some elements that are left over that can be used for other purposes. And so it's trying to be, I think, more sustainable in thinking about how to use that refuse otherwise in a different kind of way. So certainly those collaborations can be really important economically, and then it can spur investment and investment in tourism potentially as well.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of the drawbacks, I'd say on the flip side of thinking about third places and the way that we just have, the use of a consumptive third place doesn't entirely solve a lack of public spaces that we're having.
Right. It's not a park that you can just walk into.
It's not a park. So, you know, I think we have to be mindful of kind of thinking about them as entirely solving that problem. Craft breweries can be exclusive. You know, they're often at the forefront of trying to engage in anti-oppressive practices and becoming welcoming, inclusive spaces. But obviously, just by the nature of what they represent, it's not going to be a space for everyone, right? So it's still a space of alcohol consumption. And you know, we have to be mindful about addictions and where we're placing spaces of alcohol consumption. So that would be another drawback, I think, to some of what we've been talking about. And then gentrification as well, right? So, you know, there's a fine line between using craft breweries to catalyze the types of changes that you're wanting to see in a neighborhood and those craft breweries creating displacement and pushing out longstanding low-income uses that just simply can't compete once the area kind of shifts into being a lot more interesting for middle and upper class users.
That gentrification bit is really in line with my initial observations about it. Getting back to when I lived in Toronto, of course, there's the distillery district, which was a neglected piece of industrial land for forever and now is the hottest places to live in the city. And it's prohibitively expensive.
No, and the distillery district is interesting as well for our discussion about craft beer, in part because they brought on the Mill Street Brewery. It's a private sector redevelopment, like the distillery district as a whole. And they brought on the Mill Street Brewery as an early anchor to that site. And so Mill Street at the time was a craft brewer. It was before they were bought out, but it certainly became part of what would lead to the eventual transformation of that site.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, no hate against the distillery district. It's a lovely place to walk through. It's really a great space.
Yes.
So I wanted to get back to something. When you were talking about the benefits, you mentioned one that I really enjoy when I see, and that's when craft brewers team up with other local businesses for whatever purpose it is, you know, soap, food, what have you. And that ties into, I think, what you refer to as neolocalism. Third places in neolocalism were the two terms I was hoping you could define for us. So we're one for two. Would you mind explaining neolocalism?
Absolutely. So neolocalism is kind of a return to the local and a return to local production. So it's an interesting kind of shift that's happened where, you know, through globalization and this network of large-scale multinational corporations, there's been this shift back to local production processes that are kind of very much embedded within their communities. So craft breweries are great examples of neolocalism, I think. They have the local collaborations, which we talked about already. So, you know, they will get form partnerships with soap makers and various types of business services to kind of create that local network of providers. They often give back to their communities through either by offering the space of the brewery for social groups or by giving donations to like-minded organizations or to causes that they are wanting to be a champion on. They are very much tied to local recipes if they exist, local production techniques if that's possible. They will use a lot of local ingredients. So, you know, in the Saskatchewan case, we find breweries that are using local honey, using local berries, spruce tips, local lentils. So we have a brewery that makes a lentil-based beer. So they're forming that set of relationships as well to kind of create that grounded production set of processes that are very locally kind of embedded. The other part of that, so we can kind of think about it through production, is the consumption side. So to tie into the local, a lot of craft breweries are going to take references to local histories or to the street that they're on or the neighborhood, and they're going to, you know, use that as part of their naming process, part of their can design. So we have a lot of grain elevators that appear on the cans in Saskatchewan or wheat. So, you know, they're trying to create those connections to highlight their embeddedness with the local. And so all of that would be part of what we could define as a neo-local business. So it's a return to the local, a celebration of the local. That's part of that branding strategy for that business itself, and kind of a return to locally embedded production that's all happening in one place. So consumers have become really interested in these types of shifts that have taken place, and are quite committed to supporting the local through these types of businesses.
Right. I also wonder if neo-localism ties into gentrification or is a catalyst and helps it take over a neighborhood, because it's, you need to have a certain amount of money to buy local often.
Yes. So, you know, this is one of the things that I think it becomes really important is thinking about, you know, obviously local production is something that's housed within that community. The money is often staying in that community as well, but they can form sites of exclusion, and they do attract the middle and upper classes that can kind of afford the price points and wants to kind of buy in to that model as well.
Right.
So it certainly can become wrapped up in gentrification. And that was why I wanted to kind of, the third places deals with what the spillover is in many ways with these sites and how they're grounded in the community, and the neo-localism is also measuring the extent to which they are branding themselves and becoming really embedded again within that community. And that's not, I should say that, you know, not all craft breweries are building third places. So there's a lot that are building more production oriented facilities, and not all breweries are going to be engaging in neo-localism. The ones that are more consumption oriented are much more likely to engage in the local compared to production oriented ones. But even with that, there's still a lot of them that just aren't going to make those references to place and aren't going to form those relationships.
What are some of the recommendations that you came to believe would be a good way to balance the benefits of intensification from craft breweries while also preserving the character and the affordability of their neighborhoods?
Yeah, it's an excellent question. And that was one of the big questions that led me to do this research in the first place was, you know, thinking about how do we actually use our understanding of the location of craft breweries to be able to better manage some of their effects. And so I think that what we learn from this case study, and it's, you know, until we apply it elsewhere, it becomes just a case study in itself, right? But I think that work will happen. And part of that is understanding then, okay, if we're allowing breweries to go into these additional zones, if we're opening it up, which both Saskatoon and Regina have done now, they've opened it up slightly more than it was before. They're still prohibited in residential areas. And that's pretty consistent across Canada. It's not unique to here.
If it's hard to open a coffee shop, it's going to be hard to open a craft brewery.
Absolutely. And they're opening it up more to some commercial, you know, direct control districts, to some mixed use kinds of spaces, and broadening the industrial away from only heavy industrial as well. So as that broadening happens, I think when we understand the type of effects that could happen, then it's important to have those conversations around, you know, do we need to look at how many sites of affordable housing are in this particular area, because this is a transitional area, or it's a low income neighborhood? Do we need to think about broader notions of like rent control, or should we put demolition controls in particular neighborhoods so that people can't come in and tear down some of the more affordable housing sites that might exist because they want to put up, you know, another single family home that is much more expensive and will drive up property values in that area. So, you know, those were some of the things that were coming to mind for me. Was it allows us to do that audit of, okay, we're allowing it into this space, and there's benefits that happen with this for sure. But what are the drawbacks, and who are the most vulnerable players in this? And are there ways that we can use planning to mitigate against some of that potential displacement that could happen? And I think that we need to kind of be revisiting the zoning part of this with respect to craft breweries every 5 years or so, just to see what's happening. It's a sector that is really growing and changing rapidly. So it's good to kind of keep going back and seeing where discretionary use applications have come in, what that is doing to the surrounding areas. So that's part of it from a planning perspective, I think. In terms of the breweries themselves, it's, you know, if you're studying gentrification, it's really hard to say, you know, you have to change, because if that brewery doesn't come in, another use is going to come in anyway. I think we really have to think about gentrification and its effects from a much more structural kind of vantage point to control what's happening. And that might even mean things like increasing the minimum wage for people so that they are able to afford more within their context. If you're looking at the breweries themselves, and a brewery, you know, said, how can we become a better neighbor? How can we become a better community player in this? Then I would say, you know, having different price points, being welcoming of everybody from the community, even if that means people who are just going to come and sit down and have a place to rest for a little while. I think a lot of craft breweries in Saskatchewan are pretty good at that, of allowing and being welcoming to a lot of different people within their communities. I think it means hiring locally wherever possible. If you're coming into a neighborhood that is in transition or is lower income, then, you know, being able to give back directly to that neighborhood, giving opportunities to sponsor things that are happening that have that direct benefit to that community and those communities that exist there, I think is also something that can be done on that craft brewery kind of scale. But we can't solve it through the brewery itself, right? And you know, I think there are enough advantages to try to open things up. It's just a matter of thinking about some of those potential effects.
One of my questions was, how can you make third places that don't promote gentrification, that are truly third places? The private sector is often the provider, as you mentioned, of these third places, and letting people just come in and sit or have a glass of water is something that I think engaging the craft brewers themselves would be worthwhile.
Absolutely. And, you know, I think we have examples here of craft breweries that have sponsored events for the street as well. So there's ways to kind of, you know, even outside of your building itself, to create spaces for people to be able to collect together and to form that you know, that level of community that I think is really possible in some of these local based businesses.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And throughout the pandemic, I think everyone saw the outsized effects that commercial spaces can have if they try on the public environment. And it's actually very nice because it's still the public environment. So it's not like you can't be there, and it just brings a lot more vibrance. It's always worthwhile, I think, to activate that potential.
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned rezoning, that rezoning should be reviewed every 5 years. What would be the red flag saying you need to shake up your bylaw?
That's a good question. So, you know, if you're reviewing zoning every 5 years, then part of what I would be looking at is to kind of take a broader approach at where the craft breweries are currently being housed. And I don't think it's just craft breweries that we should be doing this with. I think, you know, having an understanding of what's happening in a neighborhood and what some of the triggers might be in terms of creating a lack of affordability, especially in areas that require that. I think that's just good practice in general to kind of have neighborhood plans that we're revisiting and updating and taking a look at. So I would be looking at, you know, whether we can measure the property values, rent values going up, especially on areas surrounding those sites.
Right.
I'd be looking at the amount of affordable housing that might exist in a community if we're getting a growing number of craft breweries entering in. I'd be looking at the affordability with retail spaces, because sometimes when uses become popular, and, you know, it's not a conscious thing that a craft brewery would go into an area and want to push out everything, but, you know, it could be an effect that happens. Then, you know, part of what we could be looking at is creating smaller retail We can create smaller retail spaces, which are often not currently allowed in zoning bylaws. So, you know, let's think about ways that we can make things affordable, and let's think about creative uses of some of these spaces. You know, like maybe we should be thinking about different types of cooperative housing. Maybe we should be thinking about ways to protect the spaces that are already there. We can kind of do that broader examination of what's taking place. And use that as a set of metrics, I think, to look at what we might need then. It could be that if there's a shelter space there, if their capacity is growing, if there's a place where people are going to access different types of services relating to addictions or mental health more broadly, or looking for some kind of food bank, then, you know, if we're seeing rising rates of use amongst any of that, then again, I think that that's something that we can plan for and that we should be able to measure. And I'm not saying that craft breweries are going to necessarily catalyze all of this or any of this. This is the interesting thing, is that we still aren't really clear in terms of what's happening across the board with craft breweries. We have evidence to say, yes, they are catalyzing or triggering this process. Other accounts are saying they are deepening the process already at play. Others are saying, you know, it's kind of just, it's not really having, it's having a more neutral effect. So we don't know in all cases, which is why I think it's useful to kind of keep revisiting that and keep looking at what we can do in general to kind of address affordability in cities.
Yeah, craft breweries, they have this sort of trendy, progressive ideology behind them. You know, they seem like a very for the people sort of establishment. And that's why I feel like there's so much potential in actually engaging them directly.
Yes.
The fact that they're kind of known as a trendy place, it sort of goes hand in hand with gentrification, right? Because gentrification is the new trendy place to live, and the new trendy beer spot, the neo-localism, it all sort of compounds, I feel like, with craft breweries.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
It becomes one big force.
I agree. And, you know, they're not the first use that's done this either. I think when we look back to what artists did in somewhere like Soho, New York in the 1960s, they had a very similar kind of effect of going into undervalorized spaces and using their sweat equity to kind of change the nature of those spaces, which then became popular for the middle and upper class. And artists got displaced in that particular context. And in most contexts where arts uses are being pulled into those processes, either consciously or not. So, you know, I don't think they're the first use to have this kind of ability to change the image and identity of a space. And, you know, I think it's just important because there's been so many of them that have grown, you know, not only in Canada, but, you know, in North America more broadly, and in Europe, it's, you know, we're seeing that growth taking place. So it's a matter of trying to understand those impacts, I guess.
Yeah, that parallel with Soho, I guess, is it's industrial area now, like a high-end shopping district.
Right.
But we have up here in Canada more craft breweries than artist lofts. So craft breweries is how it manifests more here. But yeah, no, it's totally the same sort of deal.
Yeah, and it was similar in the sense that cities, municipalities were drawing, like incorporating those uses as well to try to catalyze change, right?
Right.
And the private sector was kind of doing the same thing. So it is interesting to kind of to think about parallels and to think about what we may have learned in the past and what we can learn now and kind of use that in the future for whatever other new use will probably come down the line, right? That we can't anticipate.
Exactly. I think a big takeaway is that as much as the craft breweries can create local vibrancy and economic growth, it needs to be evaluated alongside affordability and existing neighborhood residents.
Absolutely.
So finally, I'd like to ask you where you see this research going in the future. What kind of questions remain for you after this?
So I've already started the kind of next stage of things.
Excellent.
I'm working with Dr. Roger Picton, who's we collaborate a lot on these topics, and we're starting to map out similar types of questions in terms of planning and craft beer, like kind of that focus across Canada. so that we can kind of see if what this study in Saskatchewan brought forward can be replicated and what we can learn when we kind of take a broader approach to zoning and that relationship with craft beer. So it's pretty exciting to kind of think about, you know, how to understand these processes at different levels of the urban hierarchy. So, you know, I think it's interesting to follow a sector that just has such a differing set of effects dependent on the scale and dependent on the centrality perhaps of where we're looking. And you know, it just creates those interesting differences that I think from a research perspective are quite fascinating on our end of it. And then from hopefully from a planning perspective can be something that can form kind of best practices around a growing sector that has become really important to a lot of communities.
Wow. I really want to keep up with that research. That sounds so interesting.
That's great.
When you mentioned the sort of impact that a brewery can have on its neighborhood, depending on where it is, I again think back to the Toronto Distillery, which literally has its own streetcar loop now. It has its own streetcar route that goes right to it. So, you know, that's an example of well-strategized development. Yep. Of course, we discussed the affordability issues, but in terms of transit access and centrality, that's, you know, a great example.
Absolutely. My doctoral research was on the distillery district, and that was actually, so I was at the U of T and so was Roger, the person who I was mentioning before that I collaborate with. And I had studied the distillery district and he was looking at LeBreton Flats, and Mill Street had gone into the distillery and kind of become an anchor. And then they went into LeBreton Flats, and he called me up and he was like, we've got to write a paper about this. You know, we've got to actually think about, you know, not just on a single site, but how it actually functions on a much broader kind of set of trends of, you know, we're literally bringing in breweries now to try to spur that type of change that places want to see. So it's interesting just hearing you talk about the distillery district, because it's kind of, you know, where things very much began for me, I think.
That's cool. It's like he saw Mill Street and he was like, what do they know that I don't know?
Yeah. And then I think just seeing that same company being invited into the next space, and both of us being so embedded in our research,
right,
in our own kind of research, and then being able to think collaboratively about what was taking place.
There was definitely some economic and urban planning forces at play there.
No,
so
yeah,
worth looking into.
Yeah, for sure.
Well, thank you, Dr. Matthews, so much for being on the show and for all your time. We really appreciate it.
Thank you so much. This has been a pleasure to talk to you today.
That's all for now. I really hope you enjoyed today's episode. A big thanks to Dr. Vanessa Matthews for joining us on the show today. To read the paper we spoke about and to learn more about Vanessa's work, you can see the links in the show notes. You can give us a review to let us know what you think of the show and share it if you know someone who might like to listen. To keep the conversation going and for updates on new episodes, follow us at Dense City Pod on Instagram and Twitter, and subscribe to the show wherever you're listening right now. A special thanks to Emily Huang of Emily H. Illustrations for creating the artwork for this podcast. You can see more of her work by following the link in the show notes. Thanks as well to Reed Kai and Ryan Kinnear for the show music. See you next time on Dense City.